Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back from the Sonic Effects. It's been a good week here, in spite. Yeah, same reality, same kind of situation everyone else experiences, but somehow this sense of well-being can penetrate the darkest corners, to be corny. I know that each of us approaches our craft work in our own way, and I've been encouraging people of all gender spectrum to practice masonry as if they're dancing in the dark or dancing alone. You know, nobody's looking, and if they are, nobody's laughing. It's a way, I think, of beginning to feel a little more confident that what you're doing in your approach is perfectly reasonable. There is always there will always be scholars, thank goodness, thank goodness, because they're finding things, you know, in their laboratories and in their imagination, and revealing them to us, whether it's a piece of sculpture or a poem or a movie or a story. We're fortunate if we're you know, receptive to that. On the big spectrum, we do know that we have some privilege because we have an opportunity, and that opportunity comes from having a bit of leisure time that we control. And if all of you people who are working very hard out there need a bit of incentive, and if you're in the kind of privileged country where I am, we have this thing called retirement, where as you grow older, you make way for you're in your position for the next generation. Oh, don't be thinking that this is all about maintaining continuity forever. My goodness, could you imagine if one person decides, and we get this, you know, it's ego. One person decides they have to be so much as depending on them. And in some cases, you know, I've met some, when I worked in Detroit, I met some lovely women who were working as teachers and administrators, and I realized how the extensive networks of uncles and aunts and sisters and brothers and grandchildren who were dependent on that income. It's important. It's the job that defines, and keeping that job is important, especially if the alternative is hunger. Now, we're not going to get into that too directly today. This is a period where I'm being date marked here. When I was a boy, if you'll allow me just to reminisce a little bit, Thanksgiving was what television told us it was. It was about this this wonderful bliss-like state. It was like the hippie rapture. Everybody sitting around eating and enjoying the abundance of harvest. And that lasted until the reality of the story came about. It was an embellishment, of course. An interesting sentiment, and one that was pleasant and still is, to have an occasion to give thanks. That's to be grateful. I sit with many of you, and we do that frequently. No, it causes concern when we don't necessarily act on that after we say the words, you know. If we say we're grateful, then it's a matter of recognizing that we're grateful for the company we keep and so much more. And we don't take the privilege, whatever privilege we have, for granted. Because that, my dear listeners, is entitlement. And that has been a plague on the world for far, far too long. We're still cleaning up the mess. This is a season where we have, where I am, a new reality, a new awareness. And we're still struggling to come to grips with it. We did some very, very nasty things to some very, very lovely people. And now it's been romanticized, of course. Hundreds of years of history. What do you have? You want to look at the dirt under people's fingernails? Only there's accountabilities, and we're coming to grips with that. And so our Thanksgiving is also a moment of apology and an acknowledgement that we understand. We didn't before. We are now, and we will set this right. And that means everybody is going to be at the knee of this bloated bureaucracy and all of their mechanics that will try and minimize responsibility and whatever kind of symbolic retribution we can conjure up. Being outdone, the imperialist powers, all this, that kind of language, being outdone by a philosophy of life, of humanity, of compassion, respect, and the dignity of nature. It's always miserable, isn't it? Shouldn't this be, shouldn't the powerful win, and shouldn't the powerful have weapons and be able to harm people and menace them? Apparently not. Apparently, it's a growing effect because it embraces a way of thinking that unifies the world. If only. But let's park that. We have thanks and gratitude, and we acknowledge. And you and I can do that without losing our manners, our grace. We can't, everybody from being, being intemperate, we don't do that. I don't think anything in masonry says, you only do this if you think that you can stop other people, you can dominate them. Well, no, of course not. We show by example. Yeah, we have wrongness and really tragic thinking in the world, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have to giggle about it or go along with it just because that's the way we've been brought up, always needing to fit in. And if somebody is loudest and a bully in the room, then we all need to kneel before that. Mm-hmm. Or we turn away, we avoid, we congregate with like-minded. We do our little piece, no matter how severe the criticism around us might be. There's a little piece that we can do, and that little piece can grow. It just plants seeds, and it plants a seed inside of our breast. We're doing something in our way to correct a wrong. And I think that's really a moral imperative. Oh, when the politicians get into it, then of course everything else is wrong except the way they're thinking. But in reality, it's not. everybody else isn't, Ron. Everybody else has their own way of finding that balance in life and continuity. And it includes protections, and we want some predictability. It includes respect for cultural differences. And these are the kind of conversations that maybe the diplomats will have. But what hits the airwaves and the media and is spread is vitriol. And because the people that there's people in the world that have to have that. They have to feel safe. We're nestled next to a nation, believe it or not, that doesn't feel safe unless they have a perimeter of weapons around them. Odd, isn't it? When I think about the monk with the rake working in his garden somewhere in rural parts of Japan. The calmness, the ring of a chime. It's a interesting contrast. Which do, if I'm in a position to have a choice, I know what I prefer. I prefer the tranquility. And at the end of the day, that does not mean that everybody does. But it means that I do, and people like me. The advantage that we have is realizing that there are moments that we control, and we can fill those moments and enrich ourselves completely self-indulgent. And if enriching ourselves means doing something for other people that can't, well, okay, so be it. If it means being productive in our own minds, there's a difference between sloth and being productive. We know that. And there's an honesty that's different than what we say we want to believe. Oh, yeah, I'm doing, I just before I got on the air here, I was doing 1,000 crunches and some pull-ups and some, you know, I just finished a half marathon. Yeah. You know what I mean? Around the world, we have common a thought and common dilemma. We have people that are genius and people that haven't woken up. Now, oh my goodness, that's going to spark a dumpster fire somewhere. Woke up? We haven't woken up to other realities. Now, that's not to say everybody must. No. People have their own reality and they have their own way of approaching you and me. Some will be quite harsh because they've been taught that, or they've had experiences that have shown, that have fostered mistrust. And if anybody was to say my group, my culture is not to blame for a lot of terrible parts of history, that would be a dream. That would be wrong because we have so much evidence. But what's also interesting is that we progress even amidst our critics, even amidst our harshest critics, we progress. Some of us learn from our mistakes, not just our own personal mistakes. I've never been in a position of being a military officer. No, well, wait. Yeah, well, I served, but sort of a skirmish, not a main profession. Enough to respect the military. But I know that those outbursts are temporary. And they can lead to a great deal of self-reflection, and they ought to. So we indulge ourselves by helping other people, and who's to say? There's an old fellow that walks past my house. He looks a lot like me, and he can't go out without picking up bits of trash and bottles and things that others have dropped. And it's not that he feels, you know, that it's in any way superior to the people that dropped it, but he feels a sense of respect for the land. Now, where you are in your in listening to this may not fit with that kind of a picture, but know that there are those scenes that is in the mind of the beholder. I've seen this in inner city, where people were, neighbors were getting together and cleaning up the place, making it look showing the dignity for their community and for each other. That was, I thought, the beginning of grassroots movements. It wasn't popular with media, though. I wasn't popular. How could you have a garden and nobody would be thieving it? Well, if you're part of the hood and it's your granny's garden, you're going to be pretty sure. You're going to be pretty sure you're not going to be fooling around with my granny's or your granny's hoeing and feeding and watering. It's a good, it can be a good life. It can be a good life. But I think in order to savor it, we need to have some sense of, I don't know what even the right word is, it tragedy or test? You know, it's like appreciating the darkness comes before the dawn. Without the darkness, we wouldn't have the dawn. If you've ever felt the relief, you've been on the deck of your boat alone, and there's storm after storm after storm. It's like, God, the Creator hates me. What did I do? Just, you know, here I'm just letting out a little bit more, dump a little more wind, and or I'll reef that. And we, and then you begin to feel that you're in the hands of the Creator. It's like the power around, the power of the wind and the power of the water. It's just overwhelming. And then you realize, that's respect. And what happens? Yeah, I don't think you ever just take it for granted, become quite nonchalant. It's like, it's okay. It's okay though that the waves are up to over my head when I'm standing at the wheel. It's okay. I've got a trailing seas that are swamping me from time to time, but we're floating. And all of a sudden you begin to trust the craftsmanship that of your boat and your own capacities. Your own ability to direct and float along. You do become the chip in that torrent, another chip, the wood chip. Instead of fighting the rapids, it's like go with the flow. And that's what you do in those situations, isn't it? You make the best and it's tiring. Yeah, but it teaches a lot. It teaches a great deal, those moments. We see suffering and we appreciate how fortunate we are. And I don't want to distract from the show today. It's pretty, it's still a matter of what you bring to your mind, what questions and your curiosity and whatever connections we attempt to make with you, with that common bind, that common link. If you hear something that's a bit imaginative, it's likely resonating within a part of you that is similar, that is like that. And I tend to think that. We respect genius because there's a part of us, maybe buried in the sidewall of our DNA, but there's a part of us that it shares that. Oh, if the circumstances were different, would we discover it? Well, likely. Does that explain? Well, Temple Grandin, Dr. Grandin, explained visual learning, didn't she? So that boy, that those stupid boys, and those boys that just needed to be, those children that needed to be sedated. Well, now we're finding that it's just that they process quite different. Their brains process information quite a bit different. And in fact, if we're bright enough, as we find that some business is trying to exploit, they look for those people on that autistic spectrum, because they can do and focus in ways that we can't, that the so-called normals can't. The normal, just a slice on that spectrum. So the so-called stupid boys ain't so stupid anymore. It's like the so-called geeks. You ever been beaten up for wearing glasses? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the kind of culture that many of us were raised in. Does that continue? Well, you know better. You know better. You know, it takes intelligence to and a personality to run big organizations, and the better organizations are reinforcing the human qualities, the sense of empathy and awareness in the people, not a sense of domination. We're not slick back, silk suited mandarins of finance. No. We're trying to get by. And some are at that altar, but that's not the world. That's their struggle. We come at it through, you know, trying to understand and sort it out. So lately I've been, you know, thinking about the preparation of dealing with mentoring. Can we swing just a little bit to conversations that would be more relevant perhaps to Masons? We focus, we're here, we've just sort of jumped up and said, oh my goodness, our education, we're in this downward spiral because education has been just almost an afterthought, not been a priority for a long, long time. What do we do? Well, of course, we rush into it impulsively with the results that you'd expect. The interesting thing is I really haven't, as far as I can tell, done much thinking about the preparation for students, other than saying, you know, it's sort of that old-time fire and brimstone. You must learn. You don't know anything. You're just a blank slate, and we're going to teach you everything that you... Well, how do you do that when you're teaching philosophy? You know, there's a dominant... So you are coming at me, and you're Schopenhauer. Okay. And so that's your field of study. So you're expecting me to adapt that kind of your thinking? That wouldn't be realistic, would it? You put a room full of Masons together, we're going to get all kinds of opinions. You put a room full of philosophers together, they're absolutely delighted in the argument, the debate. And the treat is when there's overlap. You know, if you're talking about Kant and you're talking about Spinoza, okay, there's a bit of overlap, or David Hume, there's a bit of overlap, isn't there? There's a bit of continuity. You can say, oh, he was completely wrong. But at the end of the day, the perspective on things, you put a room full of Platonists together, and you're going to hear different things and different opinions. Was he worthwhile? Was he as important and insightful as he's projected? You know, you'll hear those things, and that's absolutely wonderful. So I give you that as a start point for the program today, to think about the context, your context, for what you're going to hear. The music is innovative. You know, it's riff, there's melodies, but within those melodies, it's jazz. Just like us, I'm always reminded, jazz, people tried to kill it. They tried to kill the people, and still are in many parts of the world. There's slavery all over the place, but they couldn't. All of a sudden, there's this beautiful music that was created out of that suffering. And I think, and you've heard me say this before, who would have bet that that mandarins in 1717 would have created a body, a movement that would continue to exist for a couple of hundred years and spread worldwide? Who would have bet on that? Who would have taken that bet? High rollers speculating, but, you know, it's foolish, but what if it works? we're going to be so rich. Well, even to say it works is relative. And is it, you know, we've seen probably the nation that has, where Masonry took root in the greatest numbers was the United States. What do they have, 50 grand lodges? Fiercely intrusive way of thinking in the world order at the time, independence and freedoms and liberties. But we see that Masonry has dropped by about 50% of what it was not so very long ago. And the question is, what in the world's going on? Well, I think it has to do that we might want to consider the viewpoint of the student. Instead of looking at life through from the bottom of the rabbit hole up, I think we ought to take a march, we ought to crawl up to the top and look into the rabbit hole with all these other entered apprentices and fellowcraft. What is it that we see? Look down that rabbit hole. It's different, isn't it? Anyway, commentary today, we were once upon a time. And the music, poof. But I think the cracker here is the poetry. And you know that we use that quite faithfully. It's important to us as whether we're all students of the symbolism, Masonry holds significance because it is symbolic. It's rich. Our work is rich in symbolism. And poetry is a means to convey complex ideas and moral lessons in a symbolic and memorable way. So we can find poetic language in rituals and lectures and writings, and they reinforce moral and ethical teachings. Sometimes I get sort of tired of that. I don't need, you know, that steady drip, drip, drip of morality. And then I look at the reality out there and I think, they seem to have forgotten all that. There's a dilemma there. But there's so many poems and verses that impart moral lessons. If you're a fan, who's your favorite poet? Once upon a time, if you asked me that, it would shake my head and say, what in the world are you talking about? Poetry? But if you're sitting in a cafe in Istanbul and somebody's reciting poetry to just stands up and spontaneously begins this, where you're out in the evening with your friends sipping tea, you get it. And with our work, to say that a poem reflects brotherly love or charity or truth, you know, that's empowering or self-improvement. So it can be a powerful tool teaching these things and inspiring us to live by them. But they serve as a link to the past, don't they? You walk past the field of daffodils. They're dancing, aren't they? Just damned little daffodils. But let poetry bring us together. So, you know, what we take from it is like when you go to the ballet or you go to the opera, what do you take from it? Good. Personal reflection. So I'll leave you to sample this for yourself and see how consistent these eloquent words are, how accurate this is. This is Steve Kuhn's work called Wisteria. I just love that. I don't. All I'm envisioning is an audience, all in their smoking jackets and a cravat. I guess we can't call it smoking jackets anymore. Sitting in their overstuffed chair with a glass of brandy. Yeah, you wish. And we were once upon a time. If we visited the Louvre, would I become an artist? If I read Tolstoy, would I be a writer? If I sat with Hawking or Feinstein or Newton, would I be a physicist? Of course not. I bring this up to illustrate a point. Self-awareness grows from within the man. Oh, we can dissect the world. We can describe, shudder at the horror and wonder at the beauty. We can attempt to stop it with stereotypes. So we can examine phenomena more closely, knowing that it dissolves in time and it's always a small part of a larger picture. I wonder if we are a pivot point for thinking about our place in the infinite space. We travel out without the completeness of traveling in. Can we ever truly reach objective thinking as if we can contour heart and head? It may be popular to think the world events are moving faster than we can comprehend, but that is an illusion. Events move with us. There's just more of them than there is us. We are conscious of things moving around us, and yet we continue as spots, as points on spectrums. We can fret and worry, but we're on those spectrums, and they move. What is right and just, that is for us to decide. Mm-hmm. Some find some things easy to acquire. Some find hard work is necessary to acquire. And why acquire anything at all? We are temporary in an unending time space. Mm-hmm. Creating illusions, but never able to alter truths or objective reality. As we age, we begin to define purpose in life. In a sense, to reconcile our brief time has not been fettered away, but has meaning. Whether our meditation is hoeing rows in the garden or connecting mind and body awareness or absorbing beauty through senses, we remind ourselves memories of our past are not our completeness. We learn from life what we need to learn, when we are receptive. But wrapped in the expansion of thinking we call Freemasonry, life is audacious. We have no reason to progress and do not deserve happiness, but we do. Contrary or not.
Thank you.
Bobby Hutcherson. What if I told you that the poet I'm going to present next, it's another sonnet of William Shakespeare, is because Shakespeare has been described as the greatest dramatist of all time, one of the most influential writers in the history of the English language. Yeah. A little fun fact. He originated hundreds of words and phrases that we use today, but you can find that for yourself quite easily, can't you? He was important because he taught us about ourselves, and he still does. He teaches us about ourselves and humanity. 1,700 words, if you want to know. That's how many that we reference to him. His father made gloves for a living. A good living, I guess. He was born in 1564, April. Was that Aries? 23rd. He was one of eight kids. He was one. He had seven siblings. He married an older pregnant woman when he was 18. And he had three children. And he moved to London when he was young. London, you know, the city of. And he was an actor as well as a writer. Blah, blah, blah. Poetry is so important, says Alice Osborne, because it helps us understand and appreciate the world around us. Oh, my Lord. What are Freemasons thinking? We're going to be looking at an appreciation of the world around us. What next? That's where you get those ideas. Control it. I thought control of the world banks was hard enough, Jim. Poetry's strength lies in its ability to shed a sideways light on the world, so the truth sneaks up on you. No question about it. Poetry teaches us how to live. It's like Windex on a grubby car window. It bears open the vulnerabilities of human beings so we can all relate to each other a little better. It's like saying, you're not all of that. You know, we know what's going on under the veneer. Poetry does that. Oh, my Lord. Why aren't more poets Freemasons? Oh, I know. Pick me. Why is poetry important in the world today? Turn on the TV. You probably see why. Ratings war, eh? Portrays the world that we live in, ugly and chaotic and violent. That we're living in a fractured world. But if we let it and embrace it, it can offer us a way to empathize with each other. And in its immediacy, it's a counselor helping us to understand one another. Who cares, eh? Yeah. This is his analysis. This is a sonnet 133. 132, he makes clear, he's talking about, it talks about the mistress as he makes the mistress into a chaste beauty. If anybody's had a mistress, you know that rapport, that intensity, that je ne sais quoi, you know, and you know the judgments. Mm-hmm. I'm just musing here. Sonnet 133, though, maligns her for seducing the poet's friend. Oh, those terrible women. You know, we better cover up her ankle, you know, because that's the trigger. I'm completely irresponsible for my deeds because I'm provoked by that nonsense. So in this sonnet called Beshrew, which it means a mild curse, Beshrew, that heart that makes my heart to groan for that deep wound gives my friend and me. Mm-hmm. whether or not this deep wound is caused by the woman having had a sexual affair with the youth is not clear. The slave to slavery phrase in the fourth line may be more about jealousy than about lust. But the poet seems enamored here with both the woman and the young man. Oh my goodness, we can't have that conversation. That's too much reality, huh? Too much truth. The woman's pitiful eyes contrast with her cruel and flirtatious heart. We know better. We know they're all evil, you know. Malarkey. Remember, 15th century stuff here, yeah? Cynically, the mourning eyes of Sonnet 132 have become cruel eyes. And attempting to protect the youth from the woman's advances, the poet argues that because the young man resides in the poet's own heart, the woman can have the young man only by having the poet, whose heart will guard the heart of the youth from any cruelty that woman may do to him. The sonnet's last two lines make clear that the poet knows that the woman will be cruel, not only to him, but to the young man. Woo! Now let's see if this speaks to belief that we want to believe. Does it check off all the boxes? Beshrew, remember, it's a minor kind of a criticism or curse. Beshrew that heart that makes my heart to groan. For that deep wound it gives my friend and me, 'tis not enough to torture me alone, but slave to slavery my dearest, sweetest friend must be. Me from myself thy cruel eye hath taken, and my next self thou harder hast engrossed. Of him, myself, and thee I am forsaken. A torment thrice threefold thus to be crossed. Prison my heart in thy steel bosom's ward. But then my friend's heart, let my poor heart bail. Whoever keeps me, let my heart be his guard. Thou canst not then use rigor in my jail. And yet thou wilt, for I, being pent to thee, perforce am thine and all that is in me. Perforce then thine and all that is in me. I'll protect you. I'll protect you. Too much truth. Far, far too much truth there, William. That's from the 2019 work of Tord Gustafsson Trio. That's beautiful. She carries this along. Here. A bit of history. Now we're pivoting around 1790 in Amsterdam and the function of the Masonic Lodge, the life of the Lodge. We're doing this to see what we can learn, what we can draw from that experience. The scribe was very, very articulate, and we're grateful for that. There is an emotional intensity in the records of the 1790s. Brothers about to be admitted are called children. There are the usual formalities in a generous, merry, enthusiastic, and friendly way, after which the brothers went home pleased and content in order to have their Freemason wives share in their joy and contentment. Brothers are exhorted to promote the true happiness and prosperity of each other. Just as a father cannot leave his children a better inheritance than a good upbringing, Freemasonry also leaves to the disposal of its practitioners virtue and good morals as an enduring legacy. Given the financial problems, new servants are brought into the lodge because a servant of the new master has volunteered to donate his labor. He is deemed a suitable object. There is a drawing together evident in these records. It is tied not to cosmopolitanism, but as we are about to see, to an incipient nationalism, to a sense that specific peoples must belong to specific nations. The impulse toward homogeneity of a people, not simply toward the love of the fatherland. One of the hallmarks of Amsterdam cosmopolitanism was the relatively high degree of integration accorded to its Jewish population. At the very beginning of Dutch Freemasonry in 1735, there was at least one known member who was Jewish. Yet we know that there was also a clandestine Jewish lodge in the city. For decades, the records of Dutch Freemasonry were silent about the religions and even sometimes about the national origins of its members. Yet in 1793, the subjects of religion and nation are now on the minds of the brothers. Jacob Salomon de Jong has applied for membership, but had not yet come to terms with himself to make this important step. Instead, he wanted to confront his conscience once more with the laws given to the progeny of Israel by Moses. The request for time while this Jewish visitor ponders the rules of the Masonic Creed in relation to those of his birth could not be denied. In accordance with the general laws of our royal order, perhaps de Jong decided that there would be better fellowship in numbers. Suddenly, Le Bien-Aimé is approached for membership by 9 former members of another lodge, all of the Jewish nation and religion. This is a time when Jewish emancipation was being enacted in France, 1790 to 1791, and the implications of equality are everywhere being discussed. The answer given by the lodge to these prospective Jewish members is stunning in its departure from any formula for membership found in the minutes or the constitutions. Le Bien-Aimé agrees to approve as members, quote, 9 gentlemen of the Jewish nation and religion who have a blameless reputation under the following condition: that they are entitled to all prerogatives and liberties to which all effective members of our lodge are entitled. With this express condition and stipulation, that none of these gentlemen of the Jewish nation and religion who will be received as effective members of our lodge now or consequently will ever be able to or permitted to be nominated, elected, or even less appointed to any administration of the lodge. Got it? None of these gentlemen will ever be able to be permitted to be nominated, elected, or even less appointed to any administration of the lodge. Just a curious reflection on time, yeah? Were they being cautious? Were they being afraid? I can only think of those nine brethren. Impeccable credentials, huh? Here we are, Cannonball Adderley, dancing in the dark. Whoa. Before you get lulled into a sense of enjoying yourself here with Masonic effects, whoa. We'll get back. Cannonball Adderley. Now, get this. He's playing with Miles Davis, Hank Jones, Sam Jones, and Art Blakey. Whoa, there. We'll get back to that. We reflect on our history for what it might tell us, what we might learn from it. What's it tell us? I listen, dear. I read the history and I think about it. I want to believe that there's some. I have this sense of moral superiority that I'm not that man, that way of thinking, but that I understand it. That's the world that I live in, but it's not one that I can either reject or accept. I'm trying to understand it. And what can be done? Well, one verse at a time. I don't artificially collect people so that I can demonstrate that I believe in equality. I don't deliberately do that because I find that to me that's in manipulation. But I've worked for First Nations and with First Nations. I've worked for Jewish people and with Jewish people. And worked for Scottish people and with and Irish. And I've had acquaintances, and it doesn't distract from the sense that I'm enormously private a boy raised by Stoic people. It's not too much of a stretch. But then. It draws me along to my thoughts and into the thoughts and reasoning of Masonry. And I'll leave you with that today. That there are things around us that if we're looking through the lens of Masonry, we can see these events are a complementarity or reinforcement of certain truths. And some of them, the really significant ones, I think, are the way that they lead us to a sense of objective reality without losing track of our subjective sensibility. We take in and absorb what's going on around us through our senses. And we fine-tune them here, especially, I know, Masonic effects, it just goes without saying. But it's more important than that. I'm sorry for case of the sillies. I don't mean to distract from the importance of what we're doing. One day we may start to turn our sights here on Masonic effects toward the, what do you think, a more esoteric sense of Masonry? what others would call extremism. Is it extreme to open up the door of occult, the occult? The occult. Boy, do I sound like a product of my environment. When there's questions raised, I think we can examine those questions. And if somebody's trying to control our conversation, too late. Thank you for sitting in today. Hope you found it productive and useful and entertaining. I certainly have, and I'm grateful for the attention and support that you provide. I look forward to being with you again in just a couple of days. And in the meantime, I hope my hopes are with you, that you will be living a satisfactory life, that you will be navigating as you need to be, and that you will be leaning toward redefining yourself in terms of the Mason that you are, the potential that's inside of you. Just start dancing in the dark. And I'll see you real soon. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and be sure and include yourself in some of that. Bye for now.